Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you very much. Hi, everybody. I'm Doug Llewellyn, and it is nice to have you back with us again. Today, we're going to talk to a gentleman who's had a remarkable life, but a tough life, let me put it that way. And you talk about overcoming adversity. This man has done that in spades. Courage, resilience, and obviously are all crucial factors that are in adversity. Jeffrey Parker is his name. He is a social worker. A degreed social worker, and it's a miracle he is. But he specializes in addiction recovery, and he should know because he has been addicted to alcohol and had his problems throughout his life. It's just an amazing story. He's the author of a book called Take the High Road. It's not where you begin, it's how you finish. And it is a memoir of his battle to overcome addiction and come out stronger on the other side, which, thank God, he has. He points out, we're the chosen ones. You can't put it down once we pick it up. He says, you choose the drug, but once you become addicted, it chooses you. It's like a magnet, and it'll change your life and your perception of the world and yourself. Jeff Parker was on a path of self-destruction from the time he was really a very small child, the youngest of three in an abusive environment. He'd run away from home before he was even seven. He started drinking by the age of 12, and by the time he was a teenager, he was getting blackout drunk three times a week. And even worse, he suffered from epilepsy and struggled with his concentration, with sleep, anger management, and impulse control. He had a tough father. It was a tough family life. It was a tough life he led, just to put it bluntly. To give you an idea of some of the things that he had to run through or live through. He had epilepsy, and it was starting around the age of three. And by the time, and it continued on through his, you know, his teenage years, he was experiencing as many as 12 grand mal seizures a day. And that was really tough. He was kidnapped as a teenager. He got away by jumping out of the car and hiding in the woods. This was in the middle of the night. He was beaten with a baseball bat by a guy who he considered to one of his best friends. He was in foster homes. He was in hospitals. At one point, he was in a hospital where he was being fed 400 milligrams of Thorazine a day to keep him calm. That's just like what the young star of The Queen's Gambit on television was going through when she was in an orphanage. I mean, it's an amazing story. And he sat down and wrote this story himself. But to give you a little bit more background of how he has done and what has happened to him after all of this, he had obviously academic struggles through school. He did end up graduating. And finally, after 7 years of college, he ended up with an associate degree in criminal justice from the Community College of Allegheny County in Pennsylvania. He had a bachelor's and a master's degree in social work from the University of Pittsburgh. It's one of the top-ranked schools of social work in the country. As he put it, it's pretty darn good for a room number 14 idiot, as they used to call him. He went from a room 14 idiot to a master of social work, a counselor, a psychotherapist, a teacher, a trainer, a motivational speaker, and now a published author. That's not too bad, huh? Quite a story for a guy named Jeffrey Parker. He's with us today on the line from his home in Pittsburgh, and it's a delight to have him with us. Jeffrey, congratulations on your book. It's a remarkable read. You should be very proud of yourself. You know, welcome aboard. Nice to have you. How are you?
Thank you so much, and it's an honor to be on your show here. I really appreciate it.
Well, look, it's an honor to have you here and to have read your book. But it's a tough book to read, you know? You think you had a tough life, and you did. It's a tough read for those of us who go through your story and feel for you. You know, I'd never interviewed someone who suffered from epilepsy before. I've interviewed all kinds of people from all walks of life, but it just happens to be one subject that I've never really learned much about. Yet you
yes,
were
sir.
you were experiencing epileptic seizures as a three-year-old, as young as three. Tell me a little bit about, briefly, what that had to be really terrible for you. What was it like? Give me a picture.
Yes, sir. First of all, it was extremely frightening. I was fortunate enough to have what was called an aura, and it's like a little bit of a warning to let you know. And my mother and I were kind of like a team, and so she kind of coached me, told me that whenever I have that aura, let me know and yell, you know, seizure or something, and then I would have enough time to go run and jump on the couch and throw a pillow in my mouth or, you know, try and, you know, get on the floor or whatever to be safe so that I didn't hurt myself. But there were far too many times when it came on and there was just no stopping it. And I've had just more injuries than I can count. But it was a very frightening experience. And that also led to spinal taps and MRIs and EEGs, electroencephalograms, you know, the MRIs, CAT scans, PET scans. I mean, the testing was unbelievable, and that's also, not only did I have the cognitive deficits from the epilepsy and ADHD and many of the other things, but also there was a lot of interruptions, being, you know, hospitalized from accidents, from all kinds of injuries, and then also, again, the testing. And so I wasn't in school consistently, and then when I was there, I was acting out and being suspended and other good stuff too. So yeah, school was not a strength for me, and that's why you know, it's pretty amazing that things managed to turn out the way that they did. So yeah, and I'm very proud of what I've managed to accomplish.
Well, you should be. By the way, do you still suffer from epileptic seizures, or is that not something you grow out of, is it?
No, sir. No, actually, you can. Some people can grow out of it. Sometimes you do find the right combinations of medications and things of that sort. And I actually, ironically, I guess I'm kind of being sarcastic, stopped having seizures right around the same time that I quit drinking. And so that's been well over 23 years, and I started driving a car at the age of 44. So yet another thing that I never thought that I would accomplish or be able to do. And so again, a lot of the, you know, normal things that a lot of people take for granted, I'm very grateful for. So.
Well, yeah, as I said, it's been a really tough life, and I really felt sorry for you when you were beaten up by a guy you considered one of your best friends, when he was hitting you with a baseball bat and you're on the ground. That's tough. That's hard to read.
Well, you know, but you know, we learn the hard way. When you're addicted to a chemical, I mean, you know, we still keep coming back for more, and we keep on reliving that experience. And you know, to call me a hardhead and a slow learner would be an understatement for sure. But you have to, as they say in AA and NA, you have to become sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I finally made it to that point. And unfortunately, it was after my father had passed. So
yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, let's you know, your book really is one, as it's been described, as a must read for those with disabilities and addictions. You were addicted to alcohol primarily. That was your big downfall. Is that right? I mean,
yes,
one of your
sir.
Downfalls.
I smoked inordinate amounts of marijuana as well, but alcohol
yeah.
was my downfall. That was what I became physically dependent on, and if I didn't get it, I had seizures and all kinds of other withdrawal symptoms, and I was in and out of detox centers and, you know, drunk tanks and everything. And if anybody out there is old enough to remember who, I think his name was it Otto, on the Andy Griffith show, who just let himself in the cell and would close the cell behind him, and they would just greet him as he walked in. They weren't quite that kind, but it was pretty much the same scenario. That's how bad it got. So
how did you get off of alcohol? How did you quit? What happened? Tell me the story.
Well, really what happened was, strangely enough, is when I entered into community college, I basically papered off of and weaned myself off of alcohol without even knowing that that's what I was doing. Because when my priority became studying and learning became the new thing that I was excited about, that's what I became addicted to. And so the more hours I spent in the library and the more hours I spent studying and learning and staying at school instead of going home or going to the bar, the less I could drink. And I was doing that without even realizing it. However, early on, I did. There was a place that I would go to, and I would take my books, and I would study as I drank my 2, 3, 4 pitchers of beer. And then when I got to a point where I was starting to get a little tipsy and I couldn't concentrate quite as well on my work, it was time to put the book down and go to business. But, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I drank a good 6 of the 7 years that I was in school. And but as time went on, it became less and less, and then it was just on the weekend and then once in a great while, and then I finally stopped altogether, you know.
So you didn't go into a program with like Alcoholics Anonymous or some program to help you stop drinking?
Oh, you did it on your own. Yes, sir. I did at various times, and I was in and out of therapy for mental health and my addiction for many, many, many years. But it was actually when I shifted my energy and all my energy that I put into going out and ruining my life, I started to put into developing a new life, and I came out with far different results. And it's really what it is. A lot of people, you know, think that it's difficult to change your whole life around, but I'll tell you, being an addict and being out there every day and living the life I was living was a pretty difficult thing too. The only difference is you probably put the same amount of energy in, but the difference is you come out with far better results when you're doing the right thing and you put your energy in the right direction.
Well, I give you so much credit, you know, so much credit indeed. I'm interested in one interesting thing, because you went to college, which is kind of a miracle that you got in, you know, when you look at your background. But you earned an associate degree in criminal justice to begin with. Tell me about why you studied that, and how come you aren't, you know, doing something in that field rather than social work?
Well, the criminal justice, first of all, my father was a lieutenant in the city of Pittsburgh for 31 years. And
the police.
And I also have my own little personal bouts with the law, as I also mentioned in the book. But so I was actually, my first interest was actually in becoming a probation officer. And they do a lot of the research and the background stuff and do interviews with family members and all of those kinds of things in order to prepare them for, you know, whether it be trial or returning back to, you know, jail for violations or whatever. But when I heard that it was getting rough out there to wear POs, it was pretty common for them to be wearing guns and stuff. I just decided that wasn't for me. I said, if I'm going to wear a gun, I would have been a cop. I don't want to be a police officer. So I chose social work because it really opened a lot of doors and a lot of opportunities. With a social work degree, you can do, I mean, the list of jobs and careers that you can pursue is endless. You know?
Well, I mean, good for you, because you got not just a bachelor's but a master's degree in social work from the University of Pittsburgh. I mean, that's great. Let's talk about what you do, because time is flying by here. I want to know about when you started to write this book and what prompted you to write the book. Let's focus on that for a couple of minutes, okay?
Yes, sir. Well, what prompted me was, I mean, just the fact that I had been given so many chances, and, you know, whether it be with, you know, being locked up or even losing my life. And I've had probably as many as 70 people that I grew up with and I used to use drugs and alcohol with who are no longer with us. And I lost a lot of people who I grew up with because of this, and I was spared. And I was not going to let that be in vain. I was going to try and take advantage of the opportunity and share my story so that people who are out there, who are struggling, who are in a place, who feel like things are hopeless, who wake up in the morning and upset because they still have to live another day. I know what that feels like, and I wanted to write a book to try and inspire people, also to try and educate, to try and get rid of some of the stigma that's attached to mental health and epilepsy and addiction and many of the diagnoses that I had. It was important to me that people know that you can have these things and still achieve if you work hard enough. Now, I had to work 2 or 3 times harder than my peers in my classes, but I still got the same or even better grades that they did, and we ended up with the same degree when it was all over. I just had to work a whole lot harder at it.
How long did it take you to write the book?
2.5 years, but 6 months of that I had to step away from the computer, and I just couldn't write because after writing the section on my post-traumatic stress disorder, I share about 6 stories in there, a couple of which you mentioned with the beating and after I got done with that, the flashbacks and some of the nightmares and stuff returned. And so in order for me to be able to try and make it to my job every day and, you know, be stable enough to carry out my responsibilities and everything there, I decided, I started spending time with my trauma therapist rather than reading the book. And so after about 6 months, I was ready to get back on track and complete the book.
Well, as I say, you're to be congratulated. The book is called Take the High Road. It's not where you begin, it's how you finish. And it is described as a must-read for those who have or suffer from disabilities and addictions. By the way, the book is available obviously on Amazon, but it's also at Barnes & Noble and other major bookstores. It if you're interested in the subject, the book is available almost anywhere. Take the High Road, and it's by Jeffrey Claude Parker. Let's talk about your work as a social worker. How do you help people? What do you do? What's a day like for you as a social worker now?
I provide individual and group therapy. I also part of the job is what's referred to as info and referral. You collect information, and then you find out what a lot of their basic needs are, and if they aren't being met, then you try and connect them with other agencies and other service facilities that can help provide those things, like housing, like on the board, like food and clothing, transportation, those types of things. And so it also has a lot to do with networking with other community facilities. It's not just providing therapy. It's also a lot of paperwork. I have a little bit of PTSD from some of that sometimes as well. So I have dreams of dump trucks dumping a couple of tons of paper on me and me trying to climb out from underneath. And when that happens, I know I need to take a couple of days off. So.
Well, as I pointed out, you are a counselor. You're a psychotherapist.
Yes.
You're described as
yes.
a teacher. You're a trainer
yes.
and a motivational
yes.
speaker. You speak to groups on the
yes,
subject,
yes,
too.
Yes.
I would imagine you're pretty compelling to listen to, in a group that you're talking to. Do you do that much? And what kind of reaction do you get when you talk to groups?
Sometimes it can get pretty emotional, and people have a lot of questions to follow up with after the speech or whatever, and they come up and they want to inquire, and a lot of times a lot of people would be very surprised, but maybe not so much, because people have become more open with their personal information, and it's really amazing how many people out there are struggling, and you maybe don't know that or you don't realize that. And I try and keep that too in mind when people seem to be in a bad mood or whatever. You don't know what they're going through in their own life, and so I just try and keep my head up every day, and if people are not in that great of a mood, there's usually a reason, and so I just try and stay on an even keel and not have my behavior determined by what other people say or do anymore, which was not so easy at one point in time in my life. So.
So do you think you're able to help through the stories that you tell and through your experiences? Do you think you're able to get through to some of these people? I'm sure the ones who, you know, who are your best audience are those who do suffer from some sort of addiction, one or another. Do you feel you can help get through to them and help straighten some of them out?
Well, I definitely have to, you know, be hopeful about that. And be, if I wasn't, then I should not be in this field because, you know, there's an expression that we use and it's called planting seeds. And while I was remembering things that a therapist may have said to me 20 years later, I was still bending my elbow and still emptying that bottle down my throat every day. So it doesn't necessarily, that's where the immediate gratification from being an addict is away, because some of the things that you say may not resonate for years to come. They may not they just may not be ready at that time, but they still remember what was said to them, and they still know whether or not you cared because they felt that vibe. They know. Clients will know whether you're being phony. Clients will know whether or not you're being real with them, and whether or not you do or do not genuinely care. And even the clients who may not have liked me for one reason or another know that I genuinely care. May not like the way I go about doing things because I try and hold people accountable. But at the same time, they know I care.
Let me ask you, people come to you personally to get help? I know you obviously work out of an office in the city of Pittsburgh, but you don't, you know, you're like many others, you don't actually have a website where you're there and people can appeal to you. You have an email,
it's not private. That sounds a little bit more like private practice. What I do is I work for an agency and come to our clinic voluntarily, and then we're assigned a caseload, a group of people to work with on a one-to-one and group therapy basis. So it's we get it when they come in, and when they're admitted to the facility, they get assigned to various counselors.
So I wanted to point out that you're willing to, you know, let us have your email if anybody did want to communicate with you for information or for some help. So I'm free to give out your email. Is that right?
Yes, sir. I mean, if somebody has any questions about me or about my book or just some general questions, you know, I'm not comfortable, you know, doing any kind of clinical work with them. But if they're interested in, you know, in talking with me or speaking with me about something, I'm more than happy to get back to them. Absolutely.
All right. Well, I'll give your email. It's this is pretty easy. It's recoveriespossible@yahoo.com. It's recovery with an S. recoveriespossible@yahoo.com. No apostrophe or anything. Just recovery S. recoveriespossible@yahoo.com. If you email there, you'll get your message direct to Jeffrey Parker, the author of this great book, the gentleman we're talking about right now. Jeffrey, do me a favor. I asked you before if you had any kind of success stories of people you've been, you know, that you've worked with now as a social worker, you know, a psychotherapist, trainer, and a coach, so to speak. Give me an example of someone or, you know, somebody who's come to you for help and you think you've made a difference in their life. How would you answer that?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, they became stable. They didn't have to worry about withdrawal symptoms anymore, and then they eventually stopped using. And from that, they went from unemployed to having a job. And, I mean, I can't get too specific for confidentiality reasons, of course.
No names.
But I've had people who have come into the clinic and were homeless. And when they left our facility several years later, they were clean and sober. They were off of the medications that they had been taking while in our program. They were married, and one fellow even bought a home. So he came in with nothing on his back, and several years later he was clean and sober for probably 5 years, and had a home, had got married, and I was fortunate enough to be part of all of that and to see him leave the facility with a brand new life, far different from the one that he came in with was very gratifying.
I'm prompted to ask you, have you given your book to any of these folks who you work with and help to give them a kind of a picture of what you went through and what's possible if they listen to you? Have you done that?
No, there are some kind of restrictions just because of a conflict of interest, but whatever they do in their private time, and if they want to read the book, there's nothing I can do about that, but I can't promote it where I'm working at. That just wouldn't be the right thing. But if they ask me about it, I tell them, and then what they do from that point, and I've even been very humbled by the fact that I've even heard that some of my coworkers actually use the book with some of their patients too. So that's pretty, that's pretty cool.
Well, I didn't mean it from a point of view of your pushing the book, but from the point of view for the clients you work with to get a glimpse or an idea of what you've gone through in your life and look at where you've come.
Sometimes
I
do that through self. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I just, in other words,
said,
so they can get an idea of where you've come from and where you've been. It's so inspirational.
And I share
gotta
some
help
of that.
Them, you know?
I share some of that. I have to try and keep it limited, and it has to be. I had a mentor, and I kind of asked, about how do you know when it's appropriate and inappropriate to share in your own experiences, and he kind of told me, well, if you're sharing your information to get something off of your chest or to impress somebody, then it's definitely for the wrong reasons. If you think it's something that would genuinely help them and it's for the right purpose, then, But again, the session is also, supposed to be primarily on them. But every once in a while, if there's something that I can share about myself that I think is pertinent and would be helpful for them, I do. I'm pretty self-revealing. I also think that's another good thing about trying to be a good model, and that's showing people that your addiction is nothing to be ashamed of. It's like any other illness, and it's progressive. It's like any other disease. It's progressive. If it goes untreated, it gets progressively worse, and it can end in death. Like cancer, you can be in and out of remission just as you're in. My dad was in and out of remission with cancer two or three times before he passed. And just as you can go into remission, not using, you can also relapse. And so it's very similar to the other diseases, and it needs to be treated that way. And that's the way I look at it. I know that if I start doing things differently than I have been, or I start going down the wrong path, next thing you know, I can relapse. So.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, I know you talked about your dad. Your mother was a big savior in your life. I just wonder, did she live long enough? Is she still around to see what you turned out to be able to do?
Unfortunately, my mother was not around to see the book written, but she was around for me to finally be there for her for a change in her last days. And fortunately, I had it together by then. She became a proud mom, and my mother was a very Christian woman who knew the Bible inside and out. And told me when I was a kid that all the stuff that I was going through at one point, it would end up being a blessing, and God would find a way of using it. And so she ended up getting to see that. She saw me get married.
Right.
She saw me get my
college
degree.
Well, listen, Jeffrey.
And all that.
We have run out of time. I hate to have to bring this to a close, but again, the book is called Take the High Road. It's by Jeffrey Parker. Take the High Road. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other major bookstores. And again, the rest of the title is It's Not What You Begin, It's How You Finish. Jeffrey, you finished on top. Congratulations. Really. Way to go, man.
Thank you so much.
Nice to have you as a guest.
Thank you so much. You're welcome.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.
Well, that's it, everybody. I'm Doug Llewellyn. We'll see you next time. Have a great day and take care of yourself. Bye for now.